You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, October 12th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Rule Britannia.
And we have a special guest, George Robb. George, thanks for joining us. It's always great to have these events with you.
Thank you for having me on this great event. I got to tell you, I had the best night of sleep last night in maybe 5 years.
Yeah. Really?
Seriously.
Yeah. Sleep deprivation will do that to you.
We didn't sleep for two nights, basically. We had a couple hours over two nights, and we finished the extravaganza last night. Got back around midnight, whatever it was. Hung out for like an hour. And I slept like 9 hours, which I have not done maybe since high school.
Yeah, I pulled a 9 hour.
It was great. It was great. So I am refreshed and ready to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever it is up to you. But yeah.
So, George, tell us about your podcast, the Geologic Podcast.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. Well, the Geologic Podcast is 11 years old now.
About geology, right?
It's not about geology at all. So, yeah, like the first band I ever put together was called the Geologic Orchestra, which I thought was like, oh, it's a rock band. Like, you know, like, and George's Logic. And it's like, oh, okay, like, because George and G. And that was funny for like 45 seconds. And then when I started the podcast, I figured, yeah, Geologic Podcast. And there's this weird Monty Pythian pleasure of that there is no geology on the program at all. Occasionally geologists like tune in. Which is really fun. One of my favorite reviews on iTunes is this person who's like, I've listened to 4 episodes and you have not yet mentioned geology. Like, when are you going to start talking about igneous rocks? You know, and
I said, I've listened to 123 episodes.
So it's like, it took you 4 hours to figure out I'm not talking about rocks. Like, wow. So yeah, I just talk about silly stuff and we had our 500th episode last year, which we did a live 500-minute-long show.
Came off flawlessly.
One of my favorite looks that Steve ever gave me was when we were supposed to go live on Facebook. Everything worked great in the rehearsal. We were going to do this 8-hour and 20-minute-long live podcast on Facebook. Steve, in his basement, the SGU, has $750,000 worth of equipment that's just like the best in the world. And it worked great. We did a run through. We did a test. We did a whatever. It was time for the show. And nothing worked.
Well, everything worked except the streaming.
Yeah. Except the stream. Yeah, the cameras were great. The lights were working. Yes. Yes. The rug was beautiful. Seats worked
Lighting
great.
Lighting was gorgeous.
Lighting was gorgeous. And so what I ended up doing, I grabbed a phone and an iPad. And again, surrounded by state-of-the-art cameras on jibs and gibs, whatever the hell it is. And I'm literally sitting there with like this phone and an iPad and kind of like, we did the first
3 hours, I think.
2 hours or so, hours of the show into my phone. I had people from, I had Marsh called in, Michael Marsh called in, Vaco, my friend from Finland called in. So I would have the caller on the phone here, like, so I'm talking this way to the camera, to the thing, and then like Michael's talking to Vaco through the air, through two phones or whatever. At one point I look at Steve to kind of get this like idea, like, are we close? Cause there, Steve and Jay are scrambling.
We're troubleshooting for two hours.
Yeah, imagine like, you know, the scene in the movie where the two planes are heading towards each other and the guy behind the big panel that's lit has got this like, we gotta like fix it, like 2 hours of that. And it got to this point where I looked at Steve and I gave the eyebrow question of like, are we close? And Steve gave me this look that was like, this is never, ever, ever going to work.
Steve and I actually read the manual. You know when you have manuals?
Fuck, that's it. We were like,
Page three. We were whispering to each other the whole time, and we were yelling at each other in whispers. You ever hear that?
Mad
don't do it. I don't know. I'm over here. Don't do what I'm doing. It's like we were constantly doing the same exact thing at the same time, following the same logical path to go through everything. Yeah. And finally,
it worked, and I still have no idea how. I honestly think that it was not a problem at our end. I think it was a problem at the ISP end, and it just worked when it worked, and everything we were doing was of completely zero value, and it just started working at one point.
I'm like, sure okay, now we're on. It was like a single switch that somebody quietly flipped.
That's the riskiest thing, because we've all done this, where you're making these changes, and if you made a change that you didn't undo, then when it did finally work at their end, it would stay broken. That's like the riskiest thing. Right. You got to make sure you remember every little troubleshooting thing that you do.
Yeah. But so again, the whole, my favorite part of that entire experience, it was the look. because it wasn't like, you know, it was this just look like it's never going to work. And in a way, it's kind of like, it's kind of funny, isn't it? And I just look back at it, I'm like, I totally, it's almost like we were like sentenced to life in prison. And we're just like, I ain't going to do.
Some special level of hell.
Seriously, yeah.
Next to the guy pushing the rock up the hill.
I love it. I love it. It's one of my favorite memories of all time. So yeah, so that's what the Geologic podcast is.
One of my favorite memories, other than that the travesty turned out to be a good thing because we did learn a lot during all that time.
Yeah.
But
it's a good story. We got a good story now.
Yeah. If I didn't already believe it, I realized then, George, that you literally could talk forever.
Yes.
You could literally make a string that goes on. Yeah, yeah. You're so good at that. I love that. The beginning of your podcast to me is one of my favorite parts because it's the most personal part.
Right.
You're just digging in and what happened to you that week. I know so much about you because of your podcast.
Well, you guys have this too. It's like people know, like, I mean, I call it a one-way friendship because like people tune in every week and you know all everybody here pretty intimately. And if we haven't met you before, like we have zero clue of who you are. So there's this sort of wonderful one-sided relationship.
Well, I know a lot about this guy.
Well,
he doesn't buy tickets on time. He waits till the very last minute.
Stop it. No, but it's fascascinating to me. And even on the Facebook, there are plenty of people who have never seen our faces.
Yeah, I think that's part of it.
That's an accent thing.
There's a few layers. Accents do obscure it. It's also like somebody emailed us once thinking that we had a Boston accent, which is to them they were not American. Yeah. Like that was like the closest thing they could. Why does the novella sound like every character on Fallout 4, which is a Boston accent?
But you do have an East Coast accent.
Yeah, that's right. But that was like to them an East Coast accent was all the same. Right.
Bob, what did you order today at dinner to drink?
What did I order?
Coffee.
Oh yeah, coffee.
Coffee. He got some coffee. Yeah. Coffee. Yeah.
I say it right.
That is a very local. That's
you
a Danbury
wrong.
Accent.
Guaffey's also New York.
It's a little Brooklyn.
Yeah,
that's
New York. Yeah, but Connecticut is sandwiched between New York and Boston.
Yeah.
So we have a mishmash of those two, and that kind of creates the Connecticut accent.
But also, if you don't know what somebody looks like you can place the voice to the face, and so that helps your brain remember.
Right.
Whose voice is
a disembodied voice is a little more difficult.
Yeah, but all the time on Facebook when we post images, people ask. Okay, let's have their names left to right because they don't know who's who.
They can't place the face to the voice.
For the first year I knew you guys, I thought I knew who everybody was, but I thought your name was Bob and I thought your name was Steve. I thought Steve, your two names I had transfixed in my head.
For a year?
For about a year, yeah. Honestly. Because we didn't hang out quite as much. After we had that first interview and we didn't hang out that much. And
that explains so much.
I think there's a recording. There's a recording where I call you Bob. I call Steve Bob. And I think maybe either Rebecca or Jay said you mean Steve? Because I was looking right at you. Well, Bob, you mean, I think it's on some episode somewhere. Okay. And that's when I went, all right, yes. Okay, good. I'll never talk again. Fine.
Hey, guys, we're breaking into our show because we just have to make a couple of quick announcements. So we are going to be in the Washington, D.C. area next week. That's the weekend after Thanksgiving weekend. Right, guys? You're all going to be there?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Starting on the night of the 29th.
It's not the weekend after Thanksgiving.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
It's not the weekend
weekend after Thanksgiving weekend.
It's the weekend after Thanksgiving weekend,
there
which is what
go.
I said.
Double weekend.
29th through the 1st. How about that?
Yeah.
Yes. So
actual dates.
Yeah, on November 30th, we're going to be at the Smithsonian, but that event is sold out, unfortunately. But we will be, Saturday night, we will be joining the National Capital Area Skeptics. You can look on their website for details. But it will be from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Cambria Hotel Lounge. Mm-hmm. That's located at 899 O Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Yeah, O Street. I lived in D.C. for 5 years, so this is, I always like going back and visiting.
I love D.C. It's one of my favorite cities.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Good food.
So much to
see. Super cool. Yeah, lots to do.
Yeah, we're definitely going to do do up the Smithsonian Museums mm-hmm. before our show.
Oh, yeah, we're going to paint it red, not literally.
No, don't do that.
They frown on that.
They get mad.
I think this will be our last book-related event before the holidays, but then we're going to try to schedule some more events. It's just hard to get us all together.
Who even says Thanksgiving weekend?
Steve does. Kara does. I've said it.
I do.
No,
I do.
Nobody says it.
Because it's always on a Thursday, so most people take Friday off, and then they have the whole weekend. That's Thanksgiving weekend.
But it's just not a term you hear very often.
Whenever there's a week where we're not recording a full show because we have one from a live event, like this week, there's so many great news items.
Oh my gosh. Bombarded.
News.
Cubic wombat poop.
Oh,
so many good things.
Gosh.
Next week, I'm going to talk about Atlantis because there's this viral video going about saying that we found Atlantis in North Africa. No, you didn't.
Oh, yeah. There's emails on that.
Yeah. But it's fun to deconstruct. And then there's a great conversation in the comments of my blog. It's like a constant name that logical fallacy.
Perfect.
Good. So we haven't done that week. Segment in a while.
Oh, this yeah, will be a yeah. nice attempt at it.
This will be like 10 segments.
A year's worth.
All right. Well, let's get back to our private show from QED. And then hopefully we'll be seeing some of our listeners next weekend in D.C. And we'll be back with a regular show next week.
All right. Well, let's get started. Often we end these shows with a Q&A, just sort of like the open-ended closer, however much time we have. And it's hard to like really get to a lot of questions. So George's idea for this show is let's start with the Q&A and like really make it a huge segment and get a lot of questions and go through them and make it more of a meaty segment. So yeah. George has been collecting all of your questions over the last half hour or so.
Yes.
And has very carefully screened them.
Very. This first one's my favorite. How many beers is too many to be sat in this audience? Whatever you just had is probably... Okay, that's the first one. We're going to move on here. Let's see. What sacred cow was hardest for you to give up on your path to skepticism? What sacred cow was hardest for you to give up? What belief that you had was hardest for you to give up? And we got a ton of these, so let's motor through.
Sex out of wedlock.
Seriously, because you guys... were religious.
Not that religious.
But you were religious much later than I was.
Into our 20s,
probably. Into your 20s, yeah.
But we were never, what I would say, religious. I mean,
did you believe in God?
We believed. We believed in God.
How about you,
but church.
Are you religious?
Yeah.
Well, I was born to Jewish parents. I'm bar mitzvahed, so up to that point. But I kind of dumped it pretty much right after that.
Right, of course, right after the party
exactly,
where everybody gives
right.
you thousands of dollars. I believe.
but I turned to pseudoscience a little bit more at that point in the, you know, paranormal and the mystical.
Well, oh, yeah, that was
in
the fun stuff.
In a more general sense. Yeah. And then it took another 13 years, exactly 13 years, before I found skepticism. So I went in these 13-year chunks sort of in the first part of my life.
But I don't think we had anything that was hard to give up. I was sad to let go of the cool stuff, you know, the things that, like, alien visitation and stuff like that. Like, you know, those were a lot of fun to talk about when we believed in it because
it was a slow process. It was, but all of that cool stuff, like, yeah, we're being visited by aliens. Like, any day now, we're gonna figure out that the government's been hiding it. And it was all exciting.
Yeah.
And even like believing in ESP, you know, Bigfoot, all the classic stuff. We believed all of it when we were teenagers.
Astral projection. But I don't remember it actually being hard.
Well, was that the question? What was the hardest one or the last one?
What was the hardest? What sacred cow was the hardest?
I didn't believe in any of that stuff.
Well,
like, I don't think I ever believed. I think I was a skeptic before I knew what a skeptic was, long before I knew that there was a movement, that there were other people. I mean, the big one for me was atheism, not because it was the hardest, but because it wasn't hard not to believe in God. I don't think I ever believed in God, but being raised Mormon in Texas means that it was hard for me to meet other people who had similar views. And so I didn't have much of a community, but that's probably why I didn't know I was a skeptic.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right.
The hardest for me, and I think I still struggle with this, is the idea of like fate and luck being real, where it's kind of just like you hope. I have to fight myself when I'm having a crappy day that I think the odds are stacked against me for whatever reason. Or if something has, like, if I'm hoping for something to happen, I'll think like, okay, don't jinx it, you know, because you know inherently there's no such thing as a jinx, and I fight with that still. So that's
I agree.
Not hard to give up.
It's not emotionally hard. It's just a habit of thought.
Yeah, right? And you want the odds, whatever you can grab to be in your favor, you want it to work that way. So, you know, it's not like a knock wood thing, but you think. Although I remember in my transition that used to, you know, you'd get some piece of news in the mail of like whether you got a job or got into college or whatever that thing you're applying for is going to be in a letter. And I used to think like, okay, you do a quick little prayer before you open up the letter. And I think, well, wait a minute. My quick little prayer isn't going to change the ink on the thing. So I have to pray before it gets onto the, and then you just start going further and further back and you realize, oh, like none of it is going to matter. It's going to, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. So yeah, that was hard. That was hard. Cool question. If you would meet the people who run the universe, right? Mm-hmm. What question would you ask them? Let's say someone, I'm assuming they're implying, so there is someone in charge. There is someone who's got...
I love how this question flies in the face of the previous
question. No, I know, you're right, it's perfect. No, it's a good theoretical thing, yeah.
I have a question about the premise of the question.
Okay.
Because it's kind of like a God figure at that point.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
Yeah, well, the obvious question is, why are you so goddamn bad to us?
Yeah.
If you're that powerful, then why is life so hard? And why do babies die? Why is there cancer? Why is life so short? Why are there people sleeping on the street? You know, like, what the hell's wrong with
you? Is it the Stephen Fry thing of, like, cancer in children? What's that?
Yeah. Well, that,
how dare
that
you?
Assumes that there's an active involvement. And they didn't just set it up and then
I think
sit
that's
back
the premise,
and watch
right?
it.
They're running the universe.
They're running the universe.
They
maybe
they're running they not in charge of?
The people who run the universe.
I'd ask for what are the big loopholes in physics that we don't course, have
right,
no idea
yes.
about.
Very he loves life. Loopholes.
It's true.
It's so funny. Yeah, hacking the system. That's Bob.
But the loopholes then become physics. Like when pseudoscience, like any type of alternative medicine is actually studied and like, oh wait, this little one here, this one is actually real, it becomes part of medicine. That would become part of physics and no longer be a loophole.
Would it be a practical question or a philosophical question? Would you say, how do we time travel? Or would you say, why are you so bad to us? Like which is more
practical.
Important?
Practical. I would like, what's the thing that I would want to know if I knew what it was?
Yeah. That's good.
Ooh, yeah. I think mine would be so philosophical. Smart. I think I would ask, you know, I think one of the questions that we often run into where I disagree with most of the guys on the panel has to do with life extension and the meaning. Like, is the meaning that we gain from life fundamentally inextricable from the length of our life? You know, the fact that we are going to die, is that what gives us meaning while we are alive? And I would like to know that. I would like to know if we could live forever, if we could extend life, if our lives would become less meaningful.
I can really form a debate with you about that.
We do every single episode.
Yeah, I'd like to know that too by doing a direct experiment.
Yeah.
You can
yes.
be the one.
Let you know in a quadrillion
you
years.
You can be the one who lives forever.
That's bullshit.
Yeah. I'll be the one who does it.
And it's never forever. It's
right.
just as long as you want to.
Yeah.
Okay.
How about you, George?
What's the point? Would be a little of that. Are there other aliens? Are there other intelligent life forms? That would be interesting. And then some practical stuff of
this or is like, not could, one question.
Yeah. You know, could I hear the most amazing song in the universe, please?
That's cool. Yeah.
Something like that. Or like, could I see the most beautiful painting in the universe?
Or how about what girls were into me in high school that I didn't know about?
Oh, Jesus.
Not that you could
God
do anything
can
about
answer that question. Well,
but wouldn't you be bummed when you said, "What's the point?" And the response was, "There is no
there
is point."
No, because I know that
you
now.
Know that
Who
yet?
Would be surprised?
I know that now.
Right.
So it's like,
and
you
why
make,
bother asking?
You
make your
but it's just going to be. Maybe they'll say, "Well, the thing
right.
is,
yeah.
actually, all of the molecules in your brain get put into a jar, which then we open up on Alpha Centauri 7, and you get blown for a century." Whatever. The thing is, I don't know.
My God.
That reminds me of Doctor Who. You guys are Doctor Who fans in this
sure.
one?
You guys know what Doctor Who is.
You guys have heard of that, right? So, yeah, Bob and I are big fans, not so much everybody else.
But it's not big in this country, Steve. It's not a big... Yeah.
But like, he gets a new companion, right?
Yeah.
And now she, but we'll see when that happens. And like, he always says, where do you want to go? Anywhere in time and space. And they always give a dumb answer.
Yeah.
I mean, the answer is, take me to the most amazing place in the universe of
objective.
All time. Yeah, but I would trust his judgment. He's seen far more of it than I have.
Yeah.
I don't even know enough to ask. Like, if I knew, I would say, take me to, you know, whatever, the crystal palaces of the, but I don't know what exists.
But he's been everywhere and done everything, so his most amazing place might just be like that really good chicken he had.
That's true. You don't, you know what I mean? You are correct. Here we go. Yeah, KFC. Like this pub.
But maybe that would, maybe that would show you what's actually important in, exactly. in one's existence of like, you know what, if you find a great chicken tikka masala, man, that is yeah. the best place in the universe.
But again, it really comes down to what's the most important for you. Right.
Yeah, what would right. I think is the most amazing there place in the universe?
Then he brings you to the mice and talk to the mice because they're really running the planet type of thing. Right. Oh, wow, I didn't see that one coming.
That's right.
Or the squirrels, right. depending on which
yes,
one.
Yes, yes.
Let's go straight down the line, starting with Bob.
Oh, boy.
Straight down the line, just give a good shot here. What was the most exciting slash interesting slash awesome thing you've learned recently? What's the most interesting thing you've learned recently?
Not the same.
You read that you read or something today in the news or last night or
new Rick and Morty season's coming soon.
New Rick and Morty. All right.
Is
excellent.
It when?
I don't know. I'm just saying.
Okay.
I don't know when I learned it, but it's coming.
Oh, that's a mean.
No. Just it can be anything. Yeah. It's not. You know, we learned recently, not ever. What's the most interesting thing you've learned last couple of days?
I haven't learned anything the last couple of days. I've been so jet lagged. Oh, he's got another
Bob's
one.
Got one.
I would say that the train from London to Manchester is the best train ride.
I was going
to
say the same thing.
That was very interesting.
Which is so funny because we got so many tweets and emails and comments like, I'm so sorry you had to ride, you know, British Rail. I'm so sorry, Virgin Trains. Do you guys think it's like kind of crap? Or do you like, yeah.
But that ride was awesome.
That also just tells you a lot about American infrastructure right there.
Seriously, yeah. Wow. All right, let's move on. Unless you have one? You have one? Right. Jay, you have something?
My son, he's 5 years old. Court and I are here, and like our kids are being watched by my mother-in-law, Court's mom, and he cleaned his room all by himself.
Wow,
that's a big deal.
That's a big
trust
deal.
Me.
Jay still doesn't clean his room, so that is a big deal.
All right, here's an easy one. How can we get more women involved in skepticism?
Oh, okay, I'll tell you. It's really simple.
First,
please explain it.
No, this is, I have to say, this is a huge frustration for me, obviously. We're just talking about that. Look around the room. I have another podcast called Talk Nerdy, and it is my podcast. It is hosted and written and produced by a woman. And more than 50% of my guests, it's a one-on-one interview show. More than 50% of my guests are women. And my listenership is 80% male. And it's infuriating. Not that I'm upset that, you know, men are listening to my show, but I struggle to get more women listeners.
So that's not the answer. Just putting on
representation is really important, but it's not going to fix the problem because the problem is systemic, right? Like my show is not going to fix the problem.
Yeah.
And so I think a big part of it, you're saying specifically in skepticism, and I think the question is, are we talking about skepticism as a community? Are we talking about skepticism as a concept? If we're talking about skepticism as a meeting place, right? Conferences just like this, a really important thing is a feeling of safety. It's a feeling of inclusion. And, you know, it comes down to small things. It comes down to men not being the normative gender. You know, we always talk about men as if that's the default, and then there's the woman version. And I think when those societal things really start shifting and women feel included until we don't have to say, can we feel included? You know, that it's really egalitarian.
But is
we're
that
going
affecting
to see this struggle?
Is that really affecting women downloading and listening to podcasts?
Yes. Because we don't want to listen to a male's perspective on our lives. I mean, it's really frustrating. It's difficult. It's like historically and even today, men are normative, and it's really difficult for women to feel it, which is why a lot of women flock to women-only podcasts. It's not like intrinsically women only care about certain things, and skepticism intrinsically is not interesting to women. It's that we don't feel like we're part of the conversation often. And I'm not, you know, I'm not throwing anybody under the bus, because I think there are a lot of people who work really hard at that.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of societal baggage that we have to deal
with.
And the other thing is, I fancy myself as being egalitarian and, you know, even feminist. But the last few years has been such an eye-opener to me. And I thought I had my eyes opened 10 years ago. And then it kept getting worse and worse. So without mentioning any names, like we were in a conversation with like other women science communicators. And so far, every single one I have spoken to, when the conversation gets to like the Me Too conversation, they have horrific stories to tell. I mean, horrific.
Yeah.
The sexual harassment to assault level things, every single one. So it's like, it was so much worse than I thought. And it's, and the attitude's like, yeah, of course this is going on. This is like the background. This is the baseline. And all women know it. It's like, well,
the guys don't know this. We don't know it.
Yeah, it's like that, I don't know if you want to call it an experiment. It was a demonstration that was done. I think we've all heard about it now. It's been covered by the media quite a bit. And I hate the fact that I don't know who the source is, but it was a professor, maybe in a sociology class, who asked the students, all the male students in the class, to walk up to the whiteboard and write down all of the things that they do every day to protect themselves from assault. And they were like, what are you talking about? Yeah. They all just kind of stood there dumb. And then they asked the women to come up and they just filled the board. Just, I walk with my keys in between my fingers. I always pretend I'm on the phone. I never, ever walk alone at night. I always have a buddy system. So these kinds of things,
And the other,
that's all I can say.
The other wake up I had was raising two daughters.
Yeah.
You know, and not that they haven't been threatened in any way. I'm trying to be very alert to that.
I've threatened them.
Yeah. I've warned them about you.
I've told them, if you don't stop making that noise, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah. But, you know, just struggling to be, you know, a woman succeeding in college or high school or whatever, and dealing with the perceptions of, like, what is expected of them, what their potential are. I am very positive about their potential, and I think that they feel like they can do whatever they want. But already at their age, they get it. They know that, you know, women are one down, you know, that there's, that they have a steeper hill to climb, which is terrible, you know?
Yeah, and I think the last thing I would say, too, is that, you know, we talk about representation, but we often talk about it from the perspective of, unless women see other women, they don't know, for example, or I should say young girls see women, or, you know, people of color see people who look just like them from the same neighborhood in a certain situation. They don't even imagine that that's an option for them. And I think that's an important conversation to have. But even more than that, unless a woman is a part of the conversation, her perspective is not shared. Yeah. And I think the issue is that you can only be so empathetic to the experience of somebody who you have literally no idea what it's like. You know, you only know what we tell you, and we only tell as much as we feel comfortable telling without getting the backlash. Mm-hmm. So there's that.
Yeah.
All right, here's a little bit of a technical thing. In light of recent news, how long do you think the Hubble Space Telescope has left? And what could or will replace it?
Didn't it just have a malfunction?
Well, that's what
the other
talking about. Yeah. That's what he's talking about.
Thing,
yeah. I just read
it. What's it about? So it's,
what happened?
I just read an article like today. Actually, it was a lot of people are writing that they're not too concerned, that this malfunction is very similar to one that it's had in the past. And I don't know. It seems like they're really downplaying it. Like, I don't think we should be that concerned. Hubble's super old. The fact that it's doing as well as it is, I think, is a
bit. It's outlived its life.
Yeah.
And James Webb.
Yeah, that's coming soon.
JWST.
That's coming. A couple of years, hopefully, right?
It's going to do everything Hubble does and more.
Much more, yeah.
Well, it's, you know, what do you call it? The sensor that is like, what, five times the size of the
If this is the Hubble, James Webb is like that. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be...
Like, so Bob just showed, like, orange-sized to versus, like, frisbee-sized, basically.
Or
basketball
bigger,
size, yeah.
Yeah, but it's the honeycomb. We've seen the telescope.
Like,
and it's
18
also...
18 feet. It's crazy.
Is it near infrared? It's not all visible spectrum.
No.
Yeah, so we're going to see things that we don't always see. But with land-based telescopes.
Right, but it's not going to be in a low Earth orbit. This is going to be in Lagrange 2, which is like beyond the moon.
Out there.
So once they put it there, that's it. We're not going to send an astronaut there. So they better not, you know, have
beyond
a circle aberration or something wacky.
Yeah.
Like,
it's beyond the moon?
Super far.
No
way. Which is why we're going to see things we've never seen before with it.
That's the coolest thing you've learned.
Seriously, that's totally the coolest thing I learned.
Do they have plans to crash Hubble once it's done?
I don't know. They might.
It would be really cool if we reclaimed it.
Yeah,
put it so expensive.
Cool. So expensive.
I know, but
unlikely, but cool.
I'd rather, you know, put all that money to good science rather than putting it in a museum.
Well, you never know, man. Like,
is it high enough up that it could just stay up there for thousands of years, or is it going to?
I don't think so. I think it would eventually, the orbit would decay. I mean, it could be on the order of, if there did nothing, it could be on the order of decades where it would slowly.
If you had to focus only on one pseudoscience, if the show from now on was just going to be about one, what's the most important one that you would focus on?
Could be a category.
I'd say category.
I mean, for me, obviously.
Area of pseudoscience.
It would be science-based medicine.
Health,
medical
of course.
Steve says science-based medicine.
It has
all right?
to be.
We
I
can't,
totally agree.
We can't call, like, errors of cognition pseudoscience, can we? Because to me it would be...
The psychology.
It would be so fundamental. I would much rather focus on how to think better. Because I think that would downstream help you be able to. It's a little bit of a hack. It's a little bit of a Bob answer.
Yeah,
I apologize.
Right? Feels good, right?
The obvious point, though, is that the medical-based stuff, like, you know, we know horror stories. I'm sure everybody in this room does. But, you know, the stories are there are people that are being epically ripped off at a time when they're emotionally vulnerable.
And physically vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah, right? That's terrible. But there are people that can be saved.
You know, like Steve Jobs could have been saved if he wasn't.
We,
like,
we don't know that for sure, but that's there's probably a probability.
He probably had a better chance.
Yeah. He would have had statistically a better chance, but we don't know what would have happened, okay. You know, if he'd gotten treated.
And I also know someone, you know, it's an acquaintance of mine who had found out she has breast cancer, and she's using a really sketchy thing. Well, it's called cryoablation, where they go in and they freeze it. And I emailed David Gorski and asked him, like, what's the deal with that? And he's like, well, if it's small enough, you know, he's like, you know, like, this is like an up-and-coming type of thing. We're not fully there yet. But sure, it's killed cancers if it's small enough. But, you know, the obvious thing, he's like, but you really should go for the whole thing because, you know, you don't want to die. But it's stuff like that where, you know, people are dying. You know, multi-level marketing, it doesn't even come close to all that stuff. So,
well, I don't know. Ripping people off is at a fundamental level, making people live in, not making, but, you know, maybe exacerbating their poverty, I don't think. Because most multi-level marketing schemes are disgustingly target very vulnerable people.
Yeah, that's true.
And so, I mean, that's tough too. But Bob, it would all be about physics for you, no?
Yeah, it would be like some physics-based kind of pseudoscience. Because, I mean, I focus on the hard science anyway, physics, astronomy, material science. So if I had to focus on one pseudoscience, that would probably be where I would go.
Which one, though?
I don't know, free energy.
That really gets you up in the morning?
No, but I mean, just trying. That's why I talk about what I do get up for in the morning. You know, the astronomy, astrophysics, and stuff like that.
Okay.
That's what gets
so maybe
me.
Maybe like quantum woo. Yes. Like when people take these ideas that you're so into misuse them.
I mean, it's there and it's annoying as hell, but I mean, how many quantum woo discussions can you really have? It's like, once you say it, you're pretty
flat
much set.
Flat Earth infuriates me.
Oh my God.
But that would be such a boring podcast because we could debunk flat Earth in like 30 seconds.
Well, I know, because I took the question more like if we were taking it to the streets type of thing, not just focusing on it. Like if I wanted to get rid of flat Earth,
I like the flat earthers.
You know? Makes a good example?
Because it's a great example. Yeah. They're relatively harmless, first of all. And like that is the extreme example of how far it can go.
Right.
It's like, see, that's the end game of you've ruined your life.
I love that we have you saying that on camera or on audio for, you know, posterity for when, like, 30 years from now, the American president is a flat earther and is causing, like,
totally, hold it,
30 years, 30? Being pretty generous there, Kara. I don't know what Jared believes anyway, but, wow. Yeah. Is there like, a popular, I'm sure there's one, but is there, like, a particularly popular English multi-level marketing kind of scam? Like, we have Amway.
Do you have the same ones? Do you have Herbalife?
Herbalife. Yeah, is that a thing? That's probably all international, right?
They're the worst. Those ones
they're terrible. They're the
but there isn't a specifically English one or UK one. Big. All right, just wondering. Yeah. Just wondering. Like, I don't know, some kind of clotted cream-based, you know. Okay, this is a little specific, but it's a good question, actually. My work recently hosted a naturopath/nutritional therapist on the subject of gut-brain connection and eating well for mental health. Is there any evidence supporting this?
No. Next question.
Wow.
Makes me so mad.
But what about the gut-brain connection? I mean,
that was the short answer. You want the long answer?
Long-ish.
Long-ish?
For mental health.
So there's definitely more going on with our gut flora than just it's digesting food in there. You know what I mean? And some bacteria can secrete hormones and, you know, it can affect our appetite and things like that, right? But so far, we do not know enough to actually have a positive impact on it. And there are real scientists working at real universities, including people I know at Yale, who are like, no, this wasn't nearly, this is a lot more difficult than we thought it was going to be. Like, even once we found out, oh, this is affecting that, this is like a pro-inflammatory thing and we could do this, it's still, it's like, oh, there's layers there that we don't know. So
as usual, there, right?
Yeah, so it's like that, to me, that's one of those, 50 years from now, you know, we'll have gut flora-based treatments that actually do something, like on that order of magnitude. Right now, you know, we have no idea.
I mean, I think it seems like the closest thing we have right now to gut flora-based treatments are for people who have gut problems.
Yeah.
It's not for their brains. Yeah.
And then even there,
it's very hit or miss.
We're crawling.
Yeah.
We're crawling.
Well, the poop pills work.
Yeah, that's the technology. That's where the technology is. Shoving poop down your nose is cutting edge gut flora technology.
Yeah, for C. diff. Right. Honestly, if you want to read good science, like what is the cutting edge technology, read I Contain Multitudes by Ed Yong. It's a very good science book. It covers what we know and what we don't know.
Yeah. But we're at the basic science level. People have to understand like the different levels, right? We're at the basic science level. And that's where the cranks come in, because they look at the basic science stuff, and then they skip over 20 years of research and 30 steps and make claims about, oh, eat for your brain health. Bullshit.
Yeah, we can almost guarantee that naturopath is
full of it from beginning to end.
George, the connection I found, though, like, I do get quite angry when I haven't eaten food in a while.
Yeah. Hangry.
They call that hanger.
Yeah, I get hangry. Yeah, hangry. And, you know, so for your mental health, self-care, the way I look at it.
Oh, that's a good one. You could go into these corporations and be like, if you don't eat, you'll be sad and angry.
Yes.
Yeah. Eat more and people will like you.
Yeah.
Don't eat, don't sleep. That'll be bad. You want to make sure and drink water. Give me $100,000. Okay. I love, this is just great. Have you a recommendation for learning about philosophy? Have you a recommendation?
You love that?
Yeah, that is
so
that's
proper.
Adorable.
We never speak like
any, well, what, any philosophy, books on philosophy? I mean, just in general, any particular philosophers or books,
a lot
on,
great books on philosophy,
philosophy that jump in your brain?
I mean, Massimo Piliucci is a good philosopher who's writing today, who's a skeptic, who I think is you know, has a lot of good stuff out there. You know, just in general, if you're looking for like a beginner primer on philosophy, there's a ton of stuff out there. Again, the great courses has great courses on it. Go figure. I don't have any specific titles off the top of my head because I haven't read them in a long time.
I've got one. Watch The Good Place. They actually talk about a lot of philosophy. It's a great show, and they talk about philosophy.
That's the one that takes place in heaven, supposedly, right? Okay,
No spoilers.
A free way to get really good information, there's a lot of awesome YouTube videos that go through the history of philosophy with a lot of good graphics to teach you about the different people and give you really good synopsis on like what are the basic tenets of philosophy in the different areas.
I agree, but I don't think that you're going to get what you need. I mean, it's good for a primer.
Primer.
I think that you've got to read the books. You do. I mean, because the truth is when you study it that way, you're studying somebody else's interpretation of the writers. And so you've got to read the writings. And, you know, there's so many different kinds of philosophy. So figure out what it is that you want to know. Do you want to know more about epistemology? Do you want to know about phenomenology? Do you want to know about my favorite, existentialism? And then look at who the hard hitters are and read.
Just back to the philosophy question, my recommendation is learn the Philosopher's Song from Monty Python. Honestly, if you want to just start somewhere, because that gives you this list of, okay, and then you, like, read about everyone that's listed in that song. And it's actually, like, one of the, like, 80% of what I know about philosophy is from that song. It's great.
And, I mean, honestly, like, Wikipedia is an awesome rabbit hole.
Wikipedia is a good starting point.
Because you just
point.
Keep clicking through, and you can get deeper and deeper into it.
But won't you learn other people's perspectives? You read.
Yeah, so, but the thing about Wikipedia
is... Yeah, but it's
is,
crowdsourced, which is really
right.
helpful.
Right. The thing about Wikipedia is if you're reading about philosophy, the people who are bothering to, like, put an entry on David Hume on Wikipedia know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Right. And if another person disagrees, they're going to, like, flag it. And so it is really self-correcting.
Wikipedia is a great primer for stuff like that.
It's terrible for, like, some random hack that nobody cares about who wrote their own entry, though.
But you can't do that anymore.
Oh, that's
You can't
good.
Do that.
No. Can't just get your friend to do it?
The quality of Wikipedia has really gone up. They edit it. You know, they screen editors. They watch what you're doing.
And you'll see it'll flag at the top. This is you know, this reads like an advertisement. This reads self-promotionally. It needs to
you
be
You can't
edited.
Self-promote. Yeah. You can't go on just to do one thing, like for your friend. They'll totally catch that. So the quality control is a lot better. And it's as good as any encyclopedia.
Don't we have Wikipedia editors, like, here at QED?
Probably,
a lot of them. Yeah, you're one.
Yeah.
I remember that when I was here last time. I met a lot of cool people. I think I recorded my voice for my Wikipedia page when I was here last time. So you can hear like a weird sample of my voice. Yeah. I guess that's a thing people want.
Yeah. Susan Gerbig asked me to do that too. She's like, just read a thing and then we'll post it. It's like, okay, cool.
This
cool.
is George.
Which, like, that could be there for 500 years. Like, it's the weirdest thing. So cool. This next question is just a personal connection, but the subtitle of the new book is great. Who came up with it?
So... there's a very specific story about who came up with it. So we were talking about it for weeks, you know, trying to brainstorm the subtitle. We were sort of dancing all around it, but nothing was locking in place.
Like, we were thinking Your Escape to Reality could be the subtitle.
Yeah, we could just do the Your Escape to Reality, but that didn't work quite, because, you know, we wanted people who don't know who we are and everything to read the title and have some idea what the book was really going to be about and to draw them in.
And also it needed to be, like, temporally relevant, right? It needed to be very today.
So I was actually visiting George. And George's then girlfriend Kira, and we were talking about it, and she asked what the title was, and I told her what the dilemma was having. She like fought for 5 minutes, and then, how about this? And that was it.
Wow.
And
that was it. The really real thing I thought was.
Yeah, really real.
Really real.
How do you know what's really real in a world increasingly full of fake?
Yeah, cool.
And she's in the acknowledgments for that.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, which is very
strange. And as soon as we heard that, all of us were like, yeah, obviously. Yeah. What else could be better than that? Perfect. Yeah.
Okay. What do you think is the biggest challenge to the SGU for the next 5 years to accomplish your goals?
Marketing.
Yeah, probably.
So we have a lot of goals.
Yeah, Jay and I talk about this all the time, obviously. Like, where are we going? How are we going to do more, do better, whatever? So, you know, obviously we're resource limited, you know, all in every resource. The two big ones are time and money, right? Like, we're everybody for everything. And I think we have probably 10 times as much content we could be producing just based upon the connections that we have and, right, and everything that we do. If we had all of the resources, we could be putting out a lot more content.
What my goal is, like, I'm redoing the website. Yeah. We're going to be doing direct email and more social media marketing. Because if we increase the audience, we've said this before, but all boats rise in a rising tide, right? So if we increase our listenership, then we'll have more people becoming patrons. We'll have more hits on everything.
Yeah, my biggest issue is time. I just don't. Time. It's so, like, I feel like I put in the time that I have to the show.
Yeah.
And gosh, I don't know. I'm just like, you guys, I'm so overwhelming. Back in school, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
What was I thinking? I'm like in my hotel room writing papers before I come down here to.
I don't know, but Kara, it's a temporary change to your schedule that's going to have a lifelong effect. I
mean, it's so true, but 5 years feels so not temporary. Yeah. You know, it's so difficult. But yeah, it's tough. You know, you can only do so much with what you have, and then it's that algorithm of maximizing what you have and doing it the right way.
We were strategizing recently about doing a TV pilot, right? Because we get a steady nibbles on, hey, we'd love to do a show with you guys, you know, and with a great idea. And it's always some low-level, this just happened like 3 weeks ago to me, some low-level TV executive trying to pitch shows. And now I'm so jaded, I'm like, yeah, they're going to shoot it down. Like, as soon as you get one layer up to the senior executives or whatever, it's not going to fly.
And I don't even we're seeing maybe one person who doesn't agree with you on the trips with you. You see, and there's a belief. It's like, no, thanks. Yeah, that's fine. That's good. Thank you.
Into something else almost instantly.
Well, I just
maybe we say we just don't really know and leave it up to the audience to decide.
No, I literally, guys, I mean, like, this is my job. This is my day job, because I work in television. Yeah. I literally just got asked to do a Roswell pilot. Right. And it was like,
a gullible Roswell pilot.
Yeah, I asked, you know, well, am I debunking? Because even there, I'm on the fence about being like that person who debunks. Because you never know how they're going to slice it and dice it. And they were like, oh, this is not for a debunker. We actually have some really great new info. And you can, if you sign an NDA, if you're willing to sign an NDA, we'll share it with you.
Yeah. And do you know me at all?
I know. Yeah. I was like, no thanks, guys.
I wouldn't even want to do a TV show at this point.
Yes, you would.
Well, no,
if we could do it, it would be absolutely worth it.
But it's such a time.
It's not necessarily
the amount of time we have to put into a production like that.
Well, we wouldn't produce it. That's the thing. That's the thing that we would
have
to pay.
I think we're getting a bit in the weeds here.
Quickly, what would that show look like? Quickly.
The thing. We don't know yet.
You don't know.
We really don't know. We've had a lot of conversations about that.
Yeah. I want a truck that has a ton of gear on it. You know, like I pull the thing down, I pull out like this briefcase. You know, I got to have tools. And then we got to go to places and fix problems, like skeptical based problems.
That's like Scooby Doo in the van.
That is what Scooby Doo was about, though. Yeah. That's the coolest thing about Scooby Doo.
Totally.
It was never ghosts. It was always a dude in a mask.
Always a dude in a mask.
Remember?
So why are they so freaking scared every time? Wouldn't like after 18 years?
High.
Oh, it's true.
You're right. Scooby snacks.
You're so right. You're so right. We're going to move on to, I spoke to everybody in the crew here. I was interested in talking a little bit about heroes and the different kinds of heroes that have influenced everybody up here over their lives, in particular three kinds of heroes. And what I thought would be nice is if we could kind of go through one at a time and deal with each of these types of heroes. I know I personally have had a personal hero, someone that I directly worked with. I've had a kind of a cultural hero, someone that is real and exists and whose works or whose influence have had a big influence on me, whose works have influenced me. And then there's like a fictional hero, someone who's I identified with, a movie character or a book character or something. And I wanted to ask the Rogues their sort of those three categories. So if we go one at a time through the first one, so the mm-hmm. the personal hero, that someone that affected you, someone that you think about, someone that influenced you in a way that personally influenced you, a teacher, a parent, a relative, whatever it may be. Whoever wants to go first, just dive in. Start with Evan here.
Go ahead, Ev.
Let's start with Evan.
4 or 5, next door neighbor. The new family moved into a newly built house, and there were 2 sons who I became very, very friendly with. One of those sons, his name's Eric Simon, the older of the 2 brothers. I think he was a year or 2 older than me. This kid was just brilliant kid, so smart, but at the same time, funny, engaging. But Eric sort of showed me the importance of academia, of what it was to be a good student. Gave me those sort of, became my role model in a certain sense. But at the same time, I mean, and he taught me about statistics very early in life. He taught me how to play poker, my first, you know, and explained to me why certain hands come up and, you know, why this is better than this, and really kind of laid it all out for me. Gave me my first fundamental education, as, you know, unofficial education to all of these things that I don't know that I necessarily would have discovered on my own or just much, much, much later in life. Went on to become, he's teaching right now at a university in New England College. He's one of the directors of their biology program there. He writes books, textbooks about biology, and I still to this day keep in close touch with him and very much admire him for his smarts and intellect.
That's
and
cool.
Got me on that on that road and showed me the importance of it.
How much older is he than you?
A year and a half older than me.
Isn't it amazing when you're a kid, like a year and a half, it's like, oh, this adult is talking to me. Yeah. I always love that. Like, yeah, someone like 2 grades older is just like this old, wise
Steve
sage.
That age. Bob, Steve, and I, we were like probably all going to pick our dad, but I decided not to just because we've talked about him a lot and already gave that information. But I don't know if anyone is going to expect what my pick is going to be, but Steve is my hero, and I'll map it out for you. I know it's that way. I didn't want it to be that way, like, you know, because it's like he's my brother and I love him. But outside of him being my brother, you know, Steve made me become a skeptic. It was his initial path into his own skepticism that I followed. You know, he was like the one coming back saying, I don't believe in religion anymore, and all that stuff that, you know, we thought was cool, that's bullshit. Like, I didn't come to those conclusions myself. It's like very much filtered through Steve's mind. And, you know, just follow the path of my life. I it's funny to think, like, all of this incredible stuff that Steve has done in his life has just trickled down into my life. You know, not that we're very different people in a lot of ways outside of the novellinists that we share. But Steve is hyper intellectual. I'm hyper emotional. We're on like the opposites. But I mean, I look at all the stuff that Steve does and I'm like, I'm just so into skepticism and critical thinking and want that tool to be one of the few tools that are truly effective in helping the world. And like, Steve to me is the number one skeptic out there. He's it. He's got the best mojo. And I look up to what he can do. I mean, like, watching Steve at 6 a.m., he gets up and he pumps out a science-based medicine article that would take me a month to research, let alone write. I'm, like, blown away by that, all the awesome stuff that he has in his head that he can put together. And at the same time, you know, it's cool to know your hero and to share all the interests. Like, you know, we geek out on movies. Like, you know, we're very non-skeptical with each other when it comes to all the fun stuff that we love to do. I mean, I bought Steve a video game. I bought Steve and his oldest daughter a video game. The 3 of us are going to play it together when we get home from this trip.
What's that?
It's the Fallout 76, of course, because Fallout was awesome. And we both have VR headsets, and I'm looking forward to all that stuff. So having this social part with your hero is weird in a sense, but he's my brother, so screw it. You know, I'm going to. But I like watching people talk to Steve, and they're all like, oh, my God. And I'm like, he's an asshole. You know what I mean? And that's cool, too. So I just love it. Thank you so much, Steve.
All right, brother.
I appreciate it, man.
Nice. Yeah.
So I thought a lot about this since we talked about this topic. And yeah, we agreed. Yeah, dad's a given now, so we don't have to retread that.
Of course.
There's been a lot of people in my life that, you know, I've had a lot of good teachers, very privileged to have had a lot of good teachers in my life. But there's no one mentor, really. But I think the person that, you know, I look to as my center is my wife, Jocelyn, who is literally, I have to say, the most rational person I know. She really is.
I thought we weren't going to pick wives. Now I got my wife right here. And
that's why I went after you.
She looked at me and mouthed the word asshole.
No, seriously.
Jay, she does that anyway. That's just, that has nothing to do with the bit.
She, is we jokingly call her the ego police because she's a psychologist, first of all, which is, so this is like her job, but she's like perfect for it. She's a perfect person to be a therapist. You know, I don't know if you know like mental health world, Kara, you can tell me what you think about this, but like my experience with it is like, yeah, half the people who go into mental health are like, they need mental health care themselves. Right. And the other half are the coolest people, you know? It's like either like you were really emotionally a huge, EQ and are really with it and you take that to your therapy, or like you're kind of screwed up and I don't know what you're looking for, but that's what kind of drives you to mental health. Mm. Right? Do you find that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You're talking about the people who go in to become practitioners.
Yeah, right. Yeah. To be practitioners. So my wife is definitely on the very high IQ, EQ side of that. So she's like my EQ because I don't have very much EQ. That's emotional intelligence. I'm just socially, that's not my bailiwick.
Yeah.
And it's good. So I could use her to like always give me my reality. She's my reality check.
Yeah. Is there a recent example of her saying like, okay, that's not a good idea? Like, is there something
it's just a constant background. Also, Joss is like so calm.
Yeah.
She's this very calming presence.
Great disposition.
And when you're surrounded, and this is rare for me, right? Because I live across the country from these guys, but the brothers, there's a lot there. Just a lot when you're in a room with all the brothers. And Joss just brings everything to a very calm place. Right. Yeah.
And yet Jocelyn has the best laugh. If she's in the audience at a live show, you just know it because there's this like high pitched perfect. Right. She's the perfect audience because no matter what you do,
laugh, right?
It is easy.
She makes you think you're funny when you are not funny.
It's awesome. She literally laughs at everything that I think is going to make people laugh. And here's her laugh.
It's great. Fantastic. But then, and then on top of it, you have this super smart, calm, that's always like, you guys should do this. Oh, yeah, we totally should. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
How many times has she said to you, Steve, are you serious, Steve? Right? Something like that. Like, just bring him down a notch, which is nice.
It turns out it's hard to be married to one of us. Because we're a pain in the ass, you know what I mean? Like we have like
we're strong personalities.
Yeah. You could talk to this one at the end of the show.
Kara, who's your personal hero?
I'm gonna amalgamate people. Is that fair to do? Well. Okay. Obviously, we could say our parents.
If you want a loophole, that's fine. That's up to you.
It's the theme lately.
Nice.
You mentioned that you were very privileged in the sense of having some really great teachers.
Yeah.
I don't know how this turned out, but weirdly, my elementary school gifted and talented teacher's name was Mrs. Smart.
Nice.
I still don't know if she just like had it legally changed or if that was her real name. I know, right? And she was amazing. My middle school gifted and talented teacher was named Mrs. Wood. She was also amazing. She taught, and you know, at least where I grew up, primary education, your teachers would teach multiple courses. You know, you didn't go from class to class to class with different teachers. And I mean, just looking back at the skill that they had, the empathy, the patience, and the skill to bring out these talents and these confidences in their kids, and engage them at a level that I could never teach littles. I just think it would be so difficult. And they really did set me on a path where I felt proud of myself enough to continue on. By the time I got to late middle school, I had a teacher named Mrs. Silva. And this is really cool. She reached out recently on Facebook. Mm. Like she had seen some of the work that I had done with the podcast and with my writings and my TV work, and reached out and wrote me a really heartfelt letter and remembered things that I don't even remember, you know, about one student, which was really incredible. And then, you know, I had a great undergraduate advisor named Dr. Jenkins who asked me to write a chapter in a textbook that she wrote at the undergrad level. So I got published very early with her. I had my master's level advisor. That was a different story. But by the time I started my PhD 10 years ago, and I did 1 year, I moved to New York and started working on a PhD. And I had this great advisor named Dr. Pitta. She was also female. Like this is, again, it's an embarrassment of riches because this is quite rare. It was a tough time for me coming from Texas, moving to New York. I don't know if you know much about it, but culturally, they're worlds apart in terms of the culture, in terms of the weather. Gosh. And it was difficult. I was very young out of college. I started quite young. And so it was a difficult time for me. I was broke. I was struggling with depression. I was unmedicated. I didn't have a good therapist at the time. And I just didn't know if I was in the right place. And she didn't counsel me to stay just for the sake of staying. You know, I was talking to her and I was like, I don't know if this is right for me right now. And there's a lot at stake. Losing a student, that's not a good look on a young professor because she was early in her career. You know, a lot of times the easy answer is just do it, just stick with it, you'll be great. But that's not always the right answer. And I think I was really lucky to have a professor who listened to me, who understood my difficulties. And her counsel really was to follow what I needed to do. And ultimately, I left that program. I think I'm so much better for it now. I think I'm doing the right thing, and I went the right direction because of that. So yeah, all of these incredible women over the course of my academic career were not just facilitators, they were role models, and I don't think I would be who I am without them. So I really deeply owe a lot to them.
Cool. It's all teachers. It's great.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah, all teachers. Value.
That's the way it should be.
Yeah, I mean, there were some real missteps. Like, if you had asked that question the opposite, I could tell you. But luckily, yeah, yeah. I think that these incredible women kind of made up for those
difficulties. More than. Even one good teacher can make up for a bunch of
that. That's true. Yeah.
Bob, what do you got?
Long and hard about this. Besides Dad, and even Steve to a certain extent, Uncle Bob. Mm-hmm. Think about it. Uncle Bob, I was named.
Your Uncle Bob.
Yeah, my Uncle Bob. My Uncle Bob, I was named after him, my mom's brother. Growing up, he was like the iconic, like awesome uncle from California, which was really cool. But he got me into weightlifting when I was young, 14 years old, which has been part of my life for decades now, and an important part of my life. It always felt like weightlifting and fitness, having that kind of mindset, it was something that you could control. There are lots of things in life that you cannot control. But you could control, and most people can control how fit they are and how much pride they take in being healthy and strong and all that stuff. So that was something that he started. These guys, it wasn't even on their radar. I mean, I remember working out with weights and he helped me come up with an exercise program and started doing that, you know, before anybody else and before it was even something that was really huge, even in the culture. Yeah. So there was that. And then there's things that we did together. I mean, we did archery with him.
Into archery. Yeah.
And then taking, you know, to movies and doing lots of fun. And then we visited him and learned about the West Coast, California. That was just like,
it was like
Disney World. Just Los Angeles
Except
was the kind
Disneyland.
Of, yeah, Disney. Well, no, the, yeah. the whole area was just like this place that was just so different than our side of the coast. And he was a big influence. And then ironically, he also got us into like some woo stuff, like astral projection, ESP. And of course, we ate that shit up. And when we were young, and then of course, you know, we did the big flip. And then later in life, unfortunately, you know, the influence waned because he was into a lot of wacky West Coast stuff. he had health problems and stuff, unfortunately. But he was, growing up, he was a big influence in my life. And, so I just figured I'd have to, you know, give him a shout out.
Is he not around? Did he pass away?
No, he died. Yeah, he died.
Do you remember some of the last conversations you ever had with him? Did you ever express to him his importance?
Yeah, I think he knew that he was a father figure for us, and he didn't have any sons. He had a daughter. So we were basically like his sons, you know, like to him. And he knew it. I mean, I don't remember the last thing because that's hard to remember. I mean, I remember talking to him.
Not in so many words. I mean, he I felt a little extra special because I was named after him. So of course, it's like, so that was some, so I was a little extra special. To him, I think, or at least I like to think so.
I think you had a special relationship with him.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember we went to visit him in California. He gave me, it was a curved blade, curved knife. I forget where that came from.
You were 7 when he gave you that, right?
I was
10, he got me a samurai sword.
Yeah.
It's true. That's a cool uncle.
That's a cool uncle.
Should he give me a samurai sword? Yeah. No. So, yeah, I did feel a little extra special. And and it was great to have somebody named after you. Certainly was something that's kind of important.
That is the thing you want to sort of take away from this, is if you haven't had an opportunity to tell that personal hero that he or she has been that, like, especially on Facebook, take a second. If you haven't talked to them in years, I mean, my dad just started his 50th year teaching at a high school. Whoa. It's his 50th year. It's insane. It was 1968. He started there.
Same
Same high school. He was 25 years old. He's 75 this year. Wow. And my dad at homecoming, these old men walk up to him and like, Mr. Rob, you're my teacher. You know, you taught me how to swim. And like my, you know, my dad loves homecoming because literally guys from the class of 71 are coming up to him. These like 60-year-old cats, because you know, he was a kid when he started, and he says teaching is like one of the most difficult things to do because it's a grind, and for the most part teaching you're not. Yeah. No, but just
even just showing up. Thankless. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's relatively thankless, but it is one of the few jobs where 20 years later, 30 years later, 50 years later, someone comes up and says, man, I wouldn't have been, or I'm not the person I am without your influence. Mm-hmm. So that's for teachers, obviously. But if there are these individuals in your life that have had this influence, maybe it was that neighbor that you haven't talked to. Like, let them know because, oh my gosh, you might think it's awkward or weird to kind of get in touch and say, hey, just so you know, you were really a huge influence. I told my 11th grade English teacher at my 25th reunion. He was one of the first guys that sort of said, there's more going on in a piece of literature than the plot.
Right.
You know, and it was like, you gotta dig in there and see, you know, the author has decided that shirt is the color green for a reason. Like, and it's okay to do the deep dive, whatever it is. I remember coming to Mr. Bullard and saying, you were the first cat that really like explained this to me, and that's really important. And he looked at me like, oh my God, that was really cool. So very essential, very essential. All right, moving on. Who is the cultural hero that maybe has influenced you?
Well, I thought about this and I had several candidates, but I think the one that's for the most had to be number one is a fellow named Dean Adel. Now, for those of you who are Americans, you may know who he is, maybe not so much in England and Europe. Dr. Dean, or known as America's Doctor.
Before Dr. Oz.
Yes, right. He's doing what Dr. Oz is currently, he did what before Dr. Oz and the other, and Dr. Gupta and the other names. And he helped.
I hate to say this, but he helped Dr. Oz get to where he is, and that's like his one regret.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. He does regret that. But this took place, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, when he had left medicine. He was an ophthalmologist and didn't like the whole medicine thing for various kinds of reasons. And he went away from it and became owned an antique store in San Francisco for a little while, just totally off the scene. And then by chance, he was helping out someone at a local alcohol rehabilitation center in one of the neighborhoods in San Francisco. And someone he was helping out says, you know, you're very good at explaining things about medicine and science. You should audition over there at the radio station, little local radio station. They're looking for someone because the guy he was helping out worked there. Okay, so Dean went over there. Long story short, Dr. Dean became the most syndicated radio talk show host in the country, only until Rush Limbaugh, who you've all heard of, came along and ultimately dethroned him from them. He was doing science-based medicine before there was even the term science-based medicine. And what's even more ironic is that he describes himself as a hippie. So he was very much aware of alternative medicine and all of these things that come hand in hand with that lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And he investigated it himself and really wanted to know more about it and thought maybe there was something to this. But he realized there was nothing to it. And instead of falling into that comfort zone that he was in, he decided to go the other direction and talk out against it. And he brought it to a national radio audience, the likes of which has, I don't think, been seen before as far as that kind of outreach. And I used to, before there was podcasting, there was something called the radio. And, you know, I would listen to talk radio shows. I listened to music, but sure, I would also listen to a lot of talk radio shows, politics, sports, and Dr. Dean was also there. Perry also listened to Dr. Dean. It was one of the first things we realized we both had in common. And Perry and I were, you know, early friends in the 1980s. Like, yeah, you listen to Dr. Dean as well? Yeah, oh my God, isn't he great? So I realized that he was teaching me about things, about skepticism, about science, about medicine, before I even knew anything about skeptical movements or Carl Sagan or anyone else or anything else. And he just did it so well, so effectively. He helped so many millions of people before there were so many others. He really did blaze the trail. And it was my just deepest, finest moment and honor to finally meet him face to face in 2015 at the last TAM and be able to talk to him about what an important role he had on me as a communicator my degree in communications, how I was so interested in radio and eventually, hopefully one day, becoming my own sort of radio personality. And it was him specifically that did that.
Yeah,
and
that is awesome.
That we got to sit down for an hour and talk about it. It just is still one of the most thrilling moments of my life. I'll never forget it. So Dr. Dean Adel, most certainly, is my hero.
At that TAM, I apologized to him because I was the host for that. I was the MC for that TAM. And I also listened to him growing up and was always into him. And I said, I have to apologize because people have asked me, who are your skeptical heroes? And I've never listed you among the obvious ones, you know, Sagan and all that kind of stuff. And I should have been all along. I'm so sorry. And he was so generous. And he's like, oh, no, it's nice to hear. It's very, very cool. So, yeah.
He wasn't self-identified skeptic.
Right.
But he was very skeptical.
Right. Oh,
yeah.
Totally was.
And like, skeptic. They say, don't meet your heroes, right? But he's a super nice guy.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, right. And he's also has been very supportive of us.
Yeah.
You know, one of the we've interviewed him several times.
To help us out in what we're doing. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. We've asked him for advice on certain things, and he's been fantastic to us. So
great guy.
Dean Adel.
Jay, who do you got?
So I picked Neil Armstrong. So I was born in 68. And, you know, the Apollo mission was like what was happening, you know, like in that age range in the early years of my life. And I look at him as a representation of, I'm completely blown away by anybody who is willing to do what these men have done, these women have done. But, you know, like, not to be sexist, back then it was all men. So I didn't make those decisions. And I, you know, it's hard for me to even like to put it into words how important it is to me because it's very poetic. These people are cut from they're very different kinds of people. Like, and I think we talked about this before, didn't we? But the bottom line is the average person can't do what they do. So they're exceptional. They are able to withstand the stressors first off, they're all accomplished. You know, they're mathematicians and, you know, they're like, you know, these aren't like just, hey, I'm a test pilot. These guys have degrees. These are people that are very, very intelligent.
Yeah, it's like physical perfection and mental perfection.
Right. You know, and you get these guys with the right stuff and then they go into a situation that is phenomenally dangerous and stressful. I watch like videos of these rockets that are taking off 30, 40 years ago and I get stressed out just watching it, knowing how like they're in there right now, like putting myself in their position. They're literally saying, yep, one in three chance that we could die.
You're riding death at that point.
And let's not forget, you know, all of these early Apollo astronauts, I don't want to say all, but most of them had like really fulfilling home lives.
Yeah.
They weren't guys who were 100% folk. Like they had kids.
Their wives were.
It's incredible.
There was a story that we told before, but to summarize the whole thing, their wives knew how dangerous it was. These astronauts were not lying to their families. They knew. And it was also acceptable to their families, which in today's culture, the way I see it, that it wouldn't fly. Like,
well, that was a conscious thing to have married fully American, because this is about Soviets versus America kind of thing. And it was like the first man on the moon, these guys are going to be the quintessential American male, which is married, which is kids, which is like white.
To me, it transcends being an American. Neil Armstrong represented, he was the flag holder, and he represented the whole effort, because I know about all of the astronauts, and they're all awesome in their own right. Mm-hmm. Even like cosmonauts, and you know, and I'm now learning about the Chinese, I don't know if they have a term for their...
They do.
I can't remember
it. Tychonauts?
Yeah.
That one.
One of us, one of our kind, did something so impossible to be able to do intellectually and emotionally, took the danger on the chin, left the Earth, left the planet where our atmosphere and gravity are essential to our life. I mean, that's it. You leave that environment and go off to another body.
Strapped to a bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
Get off the janky ship that landed you on the moon. Because that ship, I was reading, like, if they dropped a tool on that ship, it could pass through the floor and cut open the spaceship.
And with minimal computational
using a speak and spell, basically.
Exactly.
He landed it with 7 seconds of fuel left. Yeah. They got, and they're having a good time. Yeah. He got out of the ship, put his footprints on that planet, put a flag on that planet representing humanity did this. And then they came home safe and sound. And then he punched somebody out 40 years
after.
Whatever. But another astronaut punched out a reporter that had the balls to tell him he didn't go to the moon. To me, when that happened, I'm like, I am that guy's fist. I'm him. I just loved that whole thing. I watched it over and over again. I wanted him to do more. But to think that they did that, the human spirit, the pioneering, the idea that we're capable of those things. Like, I'm doing what I can with what I'm good at, which is talking, right? And you're good at that too. Right. I'm not good at all that really hard stuff. But I look up to that so much. It's still to this day, there's a 5-year-old, an 11-year-old, a 16-year-old, a 25-year-old in me that looks at that and is just like, oh my God, it's so awesome. What's cooler than that? That blows away any movie I've ever seen. That blows away any cool, you know, Han Solo is great, but he's nothing compared to these real guys that did this stuff.
That's awesome. There's this new movie coming out, First Man.
I know, Jay, weren't you saying you're kind of nervous to watch it?
Yes.
You like don't want to see it because how is he going to be portrayed?
And but here's the thing. The writer-director did Whiplash and La La Land, two films that I hate with a passion. Yeah. Whiplash is one of the worst movies ever made ever in the history of cinema. And I'm like,
didn't he get an Oscar now?
I know.
The acting
get an Oscar
good.
Win.
The one Oscar win. Really, you know, it went to, I like J.K. Simmons, so he's a great actor and fine. Right, but it's a horrible film.
Oh, yeah, he won. For
he won, yeah.
If you want to have a great 20 minutes of your life, listen to George's podcast where I just re-listened to that episode for some reason. I was bored.
Whiplash.
He totals this movie, and the way you preempt the whole thing is magic.
Well, if you're an expert in anything, don't watch a movie about your expertise.
No, I know, but it wasn't about expertise. Blah, 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 blah.
It was worse than that.
It's the same writer-director, and I'm worried that he's going to pull a Whiplash on Neil, and we're going to riot. We're going to attack the Smithsonian with torches or something because...
Don't take it out on the Smithsonian.
No, I mean, like, what do we do? Like, because if it's... I mean, if he's like... If he makes a Whiplash version of the story of the men on the moon. Oh my God, that's awful.
And the part of the problem is most people won't know.
This is how it
right.
Yeah. Part of the problem is that kids today, that's going to be what they think of when they think of the moon landing. Right. That's what film does.
Well, that's what I'm worried about. I don't want to bring
this up. There is a little controversial.
Anyway,
we'll get into that though.
All right, we're zipping along here.
Okay, so we agreed that Carl Sagan's a given, right? Yeah. That's like, we don't have to mention him.
Last night at the extravaganza, one of the clues was Carl Sagan, remember? And who was reading the clues?
So Steve.
I was guessing, right?
You were guessing.
Steve was trying to get me to say something. Oh, and Steve said, who's my hero? And like, well, I didn't miss it. It was Carl Sagan.
Oh, yeah. That was the answer. Yeah. In 2 seconds.
Right. So he's a gift.
Right.
The other person who I think had I have a lot of intellectual heroes, people that I read, that I, you know, follow, that influenced my career, my career as a science communicator. But I think definitely the one person who had the most influence was Stephen Jay Gould. Probably actually had more of an influence on me than Carl Sagan, although, you know, Carl Sagan was more on the nose in terms of what we're doing now. But, you know, Gould was a paleontologist. He was the curator of the Invertebrate Museum or whatever at Harvard, I think. But he was a popularizer. He wrote, I'm sure, how many people here have read Stephen Jay Gould? Probably most, right? Yeah. He's, not as many as I would have thought. He wrote, a monthly essay in Natural History Magazine and wrote a couple of dozen books. He is probably the best essayist I've ever read to this day. You know, he had it down to an art form, you know, so he was able to take two things that you would no idea were connected and find the intellectual connection between the two of them and make like a story out of it that allowed you to completely wrap your head around a concept you didn't know existed before you read the essay. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, yeah, that, now I totally get that. Like he expanded your intellectual horizons. Yep. And was just a pleasure to read. And he did plenty punches, you know. Right. He was very unassuming. Like, he wasn't trying to be in your face or anything. He was just, this is the way it is. He didn't hold back on his vocabulary. He's like, you'll figure out what the words mean, you know. There they are. You know, he's like, you need to know. This is what you can't read. You can't talk about the life of the earth without knowing the epochs and the ages. Like, that's like the background. You got to know that, right? In order to have a conversation about, like, what happened in the past, you know? So he was trying to, like, hold that carrot out in front of the reader to make you work a little harder.
Sure.
But it worked. Like, it was in a totally workable way. And so I fashioned my writing after his. He is the person that I try to write like.
Very nice.
Stephen Jay
Gould. Very nice. The coolest Stephen Jay Gould thing I ever saw. His books are fantastic, obviously. He was doing a reading for some television show, or it was some kind of like C-SPAN books or something like that. And so he's doing a reading and being interviewed about about his latest book. I forget which book it is. And his son was autistic.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was his only son, or but he had a son that had autism. And apparently one of the last paragraphs of one of these books was about his son. And so the interviewer says, if you'd be so kind, because they want to have this final moment of the interview, if you could read the final pages of your latest book, and we could end on that. And Gould says, no, thanks. And we're watching this, I'm thinking like, good for you. He didn't want it to be this like emotional maudlin thing. He was more interested in the subject of the book.
Yeah.
That's the way he ended the book, and it was a personal story. And he said no to the guy. Like, no, I'm not interested in that. Thanks. Like, I'm not going to go for the easy. Like, Yeah, seriously. And the guy's like, okay. Oh, all right.
Then, like, maybe you should have done your pre-interview.
I'm like, yeah, man. Yeah, like, and that's it. Was like, it's okay to say no. I'm not going to do that kind of syrupy thing you want me to do. I'm not going to do it. So that was that. Yeah, but
yeah,
very cool.
Anyone here ever heard of The Simpsons? By the way, Matt Groening is the creator of The Simpsons. When asked by a TV Guide after 25-year anniversary, "What's your favorite Simpsons episode?" It was the Stephen Jay Gould episode, the one where Lisa finds the angel, the big skepticism episode, and that's his favorite episode.
That's cool. So, Bob, what do you got?
I have a lot in common with the guys. Of course, Carl Sagan was huge. Even some of the other people that Steve mentioned also impacted me. So I was trying to think of somebody that maybe impacted me earlier in my life. And Isaac Asimov was an obvious one. And one of the things that surprised me as I've been thinking about it in the past day was the tentacles that came out of his works of his fiction and also impacted me. Things that you wouldn't think, like science fiction art. Some of his books had really imaginative and creative artwork on the cover, and that is something that I really appreciate. Science, of course, because this is a guy that wrote, I think, more different types of books than anybody ever. I think he published over 400. Think about it.
I think he published more nonfiction than fiction.
Yeah, just the sheer number was amazing. I was talking to Steve about it and how, you know, publishers don't want you to stray from your genre because that's how you. That's your area. That's your niche.
Audience,
right. Yeah. But he had his brand was so strong that it didn't matter what he did. I mean, he did mysteries, textbooks, thrillers. He did so many different things. But I mainly read like his science fiction, maybe some of his physics stuff, but mainly his science fiction. And it really, he fostered such a love of science fiction. To this day, if you look at my Audible account, you'll see science fiction, so many science fiction books. His robot series, one of the things that got me into robots, the laws of robotics, artificial intelligence, all these things that I'm just so fascinated with that he touched upon in such an amazing way. His Foundation series, one of the iconic science fiction series. I hold that up next to Dune. And I'm still waiting for the miniseries of the Foundation series that's been talked about.
Yeah. No, they're
talked
doing
about.
That,
yeah, right? I'll believe it when I see it. I've been hearing about it for decades. So I really definitely wanted to give a shout out to Isaac Asimov.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah. Let's go right down the line.
Yeah.
No explanation. I just want to hear who your fictional hero is because we're running short on time. Yeah. So just right down the line, boom, 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 boom. And if you want to find out more, accost these guys in the bar later.
Batman.
I love it.
Batman since I was a kid, and then just awesome. Especially the Frank Miller 1986 Dark Knight. I mean, just, oh my gosh, I'd never fallen in love with a comic so much as that one. Batman.
Nice. Jay.
Captain Kirk.
Captain Kirk. Steve.
I have an honorable mention, too.
Okay.
My honorable mention is Jonathan Creek. You guys probably know that. But number one is The Doctor.
The Doctor.
Just all the doctors.
Really? Yeah. Who's Jonathan Creek? I'm sorry for my ignorance.
Jonathan Creek is it's a British series.
Yeah.
He's a magician, but he's not a stage magician. He's the person who makes the magic tricks.
Okay.
And then the buffoon pretty boy does the tricks on stage. But he's a skeptic who knows magic, who solves mysteries and debunks pseudoscience.
This is comics? This is, what is this? It's a TV show?
TV show.
Never heard of it.
Awesome.
Wow. Oh, cool. All right.
So mine's two, but they have the same name. They're both named Ellie. Got Ellie Arroway from Contact and Ellie Sattler. Anybody else in this room know who that is? She's the paleontologist in Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
Bob?
Rick Sanchez,
really? All right.
Well, I mean,
that's a good answer.
I wanted to throw that out there, but Spock, of course, Spock. But Rick.
Over
is,
Kirk? Spock over Kirk, sure.
It begins.
Kirk is obviously up there, but you pick Kirk. I'm not going to do Kirk 2, you know, type of shit. So I want to do something kind of out of the box a little bit that you might not.
Yeah, but now that everybody knows that we didn't want to have the same hero, would you pick Spock over Kirk?
Steve would.
Absolutely. I think they're, for me, they're two sides of the same coin.
I mean, that was part of my dilemma, because I think McCoy is mixed in there too, because the three of them really.
Picard.
Picard. Yeah. I can debate Picard all of you awesome. Bastards right now. And I love Picard. Picard's awesome.
Can keep his dick in his pants. That's number one. That's important. That's key. So can Spock, but that's a different thing. Three of them, I think.
You can't say that. Yeah. You don't know that.
Picard?
You saw him with the underwear. I saw his dude. He's wearing a robe.
Hey, man. Picard gets offered the woman who is genetically engineered to be his perfect mate.
The metamorph.
And he says no because it's not his place. Dude. Dude, that's pretty hardcore.
I always hope they'd hook up like
at
you
some
know,
point
later,
yeah.
later on.
Look, I can't take Ooh, I cannot take right. anything away from that character. I think Picard is amazing, and but Kirk, I grew up with Kirk, but Kirk,
yeah.
the competence porn, and the Kirk is such a good guy to
the
me.
What?
Competence,
the
okay.
competency porn. Like he's so they're so good at their job that it's just fun watching people interact that way and work on problems together. That's Star Trek.
I would if you want competency porn. Yeah. Next Generation is like, right? It's like,
yeah. Yeah.
Kirk actually is much more in control of himself. Picard breaks the Prime Directive way more than Kirk does.
He does because he understands sometimes some rules are not, are there's more important things than necessarily the letter of the law.
Right, but so finding loopholes can be very important.
Let me ask you one question. Because they're both awesome and you can't
take
it away.
Awesome.
And because I grew up, you know, Star Trek was on TV when I grew up, and he was, you know, he was really a hero. I mean, there are scenes I can tell you pluck right out of the, you know, like, my God, like, that's so cool, I can't take
it.
He's
a cultural icon for a reason.
If you were in a situation on a ship, who would you want to problem solve it, Picard or Kirk? Shit's going down. You're on the bridge. Doesn't matter, whatever. Just they both can operate the ship, say, equally, whatever ship they're on. Who would you want to fix the problem?
Like, on their own, they can't use the crew?
No. Who would you want to be at the helm?
All right,
in the captainship.
I still think Picard is a better problem. He's going to use his resources better and more smartly than I think Kirk would. And I think Kirk relies on luck, the very thing we started with this whole conversation about, my realizing there's no such thing, on his gut and luck way more than he probably should. And that's at some point his car is going to get punched because he's going to be that thing. Oh, I feel lucky. I feel it's going to work. Whereas Picard has that sort of, in essence, I'm understanding the best of everyone's resources, and I'm going to use that to the best of my ability. You know, in a dangerous situation, I would go. Yeah, it's more fun with Kirk, absolutely. But
what do you got? I got to hear. Yeah. Now we got
to
do this.
Oh, why? We have to pick now?
Just pick one. Which one would you? Who would you want to problem solve your pending doom?
Picard.
Steve.
I think George makes a solid point.
Should I even bother?
I literally don't care. Tuned out of this conversation.
That's bullshit.
She says Janeway.
Bob's right.
I think if you count who saved the universe.
You're stop doing it. This is your loophole bullshit. You're on the bridge.
It's not a loophole. I'll go with you, Jay Kirk. He had such an influence on our lives growing up. When you're watching Kirk, when you're like 8 to 16 years old, I mean, he was the man. I mean, sure, culture changed, attitudes change, but he was such an amazing, larger than life. I mean, he epitomizes larger than life.
I'll go
with you, Jay.
Who do you want representing humanity on a first contact
Picard.
Mission?
Picard.
Kirk or Picard?
Of course.
I'm curious now. Let me just ask.
Who do I want to introduce my daughter to? Picard. Yes, of course. Yeah.
Going back to my original premise on who would you want to troubleshoot the pending doom of the ship?
Data.
Right?
Data.
Data or Spock?
Data.
George, do the clap thing. Would you pick? Who would you pick?
So those at the helm, you want Captain Kirk at the helm? And those who want the correct answer. Yeah.
Now wait, that would have been funny. That would have been funny if you did Kirk two claps, and then Picard, and they all said, "I don't give a crap." Like, that would have been hilarious. Right.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't give a crap? Okay, good.
Hey. Good. Somebody good. Back
There's
there.
One of you out there.
Very nice.
All right.
I am so psyched for Picard's new series.
Oh, oh my God! Man. We're so we're done with this conversation.
No, no. What I hate is that I constantly like my mantra is like, please don't screw it up. Please don't screw it up. Right? Yeah. It's got to be good. Yeah. He is such a good actor to
please
me.
Please don't screw it up.
Man, I love
please
him.
Don't screw it up. Anyway. Yeah. Do we have time for?
We're gonna do a quick science.
Quick science fiction. Bobby, take it away.
It's time for science or fiction.
We're doing it about Manchester.
Okay.
No help, please.
Yeah, so we should not poll the audience before the...
No polling. This...
Okay, they know the answers.
No. All right.
I made that mistake.
Well, wait, they're not all from Manchester.
All right, science fiction, here we go. The world's first stored program computer was created in Manchester.
The world stored program
computer, yes.
Don't know what that is.
Okay. A milestone in scientific history, the first splitting of an atom happened in Manchester in 1917. And the Liverpool-Manchester Railroad line was the first public locomotive in the world. So,
Bob, when you say stored, you're saying not punch cards, you're saying like on a hard drive?
Yeah, I mean... Right, it's running a program. It's not like a calculator where you could real time solve things. It's running a program, stored program.
Got it.
All right, so let's go. Let's just go down.
Oh, wait, punch cards are stored. I mean, is that
stored program computer? Splitting of an atom.
Yeah,
Liverpool Manchester Railroad. That's it.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna go first, and I know. Oh, I have to say which one's fiction.
Right. Which one's fiction?
Yeah.
That's the game.
I forgot. That's the game I play every.
We're sleep deprived.
Because I'm always like, yes, I know which one is science. And I'm like, crap, there's another one. I feel like the obvious one is the railroad, and you probably screwed some things up, and it actually went through London. A milestone inside of the splitting of an atom? Where did that happen in 1917? Was that, I feel, a store program computer? I have no idea. I'll say sure, that's science. I don't know. Yeah, I'm going to say the fiction is the railroad one, because he's trying to do a gotcha. I feel like the first railroad was here in the UK, but maybe it wasn't Liverpool, Manchester. So yeah. I'll say that's the fiction.
Yeah. I mean, the things I know to inform this, I know that someone told me that recently that they're trying to like make Manchester like a Silicon Valley kind of hub in the UK. So maybe that kind of goes along with the first one. Mm-hmm. And I know like the first railroad was in the UK. So, but again, Bob could have tweaked that. But I'll go with that. I'll say the splitting of the atom is the fiction. I'll go with the obvious answer rather than try to feel like Bob is screwing me over.
Where do you think that
over.
Happened?
Not here. I would say. He probably. I mean, it could have been in Germany, or it could, or the U.S. would be my guess. Yeah.
Liverpool.
No.
Come on, Evan.
That was last night.
Evan's is so good.
This is so good at it.
So bad.
You could almost be a Beatle. Seriously.
I am going to go with Kara and say it's the train.
I apologize.
What'd you think, Paul? Which one?
I think it's the one about the atom, actually. History of the first splitting of the atom happened in Manchester in 1917.
You think that's the fiction?
Don't believe that. I think that one's the fiction.
Hey, you, sorry.
I think it's the train one, Paul.
What if you swept us?
That's good, George.
So the computer could be the sweep. We're all split.
All right, Bob.
All right.
Bring us home, baby. So three trains, two atoms.
Are we going to poll the audience before he
reveals? Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yes, poll the audience. All right. Who? What's the first one?
Stored computer.
So the stored. If you think the stored computer is the fiction, ooh, okay. If you think the
splitting
the atom is the fiction,
shit.
Ooh, okay. If you think the train, if you think the train is the fiction.
Okay.
So Adam. Pretty much.
I saw
two.
Manchester. Someone from Manchester just clapped.
Two seems to be at the front here.
The world's first stored program computer was created in Manchester. True.
Yay.
I did not know
cool.
that. This is cool. This is fascinating. Built at the Victoria University of Manchester, England, by Williams, Kilbum, and Tufel. This is known as the Manchester Baby. It ran its first program on June 21st, 1948.
Wow.
So this is the distinction. The first working machine to contain all the elements essential to a modern electronic computer. This wasn't especially powerful. It wasn't especially revolutionary if you considered its disparate parts, but altogether, it was the basis that modern computers were based on this guy.
Did Turing have anything to do with it? No, separate from that? Oh, he did.
I would suspect.
No, but I'm saying Turing was an early computational pioneer, obviously. Yeah. So I don't know if this specific he worked on it.
This led eventually to the Ferranti Mark I, which was the world's first commercially available general purpose computer. Cool. And then that one. Some of the computers, like the IBM computers that you might have thought was the first, was based off of that. So this is amazing. I did not know this. That's fascinating. So let's jump to the third one. The Liverpool Manchester Railroad line was the first public locomotive in the world. False. I was hoping to get Steve with that because he had mentioned just a few days ago about that.
Wait, does that mean-
Yes.
Yes. I'm so confused by this game.
So it's a little subtle. The 40-kilometer-long route from Stockton to Darlington. I love Darlington. Isn't that just a great town? Yeah. Opened September 1825. Locomotive. What is that?
Train.
Is that a typo?
Yeah.
No. It's the first locomotive hauled public railway.
It said bald.
In the world. The first one.
Does that go through London? It doesn't. Oh, interesting.
So in 1830, the Liverpool and Manchester Railway opened. So it was definitely a few years after that. Cool. But, I mean, the one in Manchester was so many firsts, and just because you missed that one by a few years, the one in Manchester set the pattern for modern railways. The world's first intercity passenger railway in Manchester, the first to have scheduled services, terminal stations, and services as we know them today. So a tremendous amount to be proud of.
Very similar to the computer, you know, like this just started the...
Number two, which means the second a milestone in scientific history, the first splitting of an atom happened in Manchester in 1917, is true. This really renewed my appreciation of Ernest Rutherford. Of course, I knew about him, but... It's been a while since I really dug a little deeper into him. Many people believe this happened in Switzerland, the first splitting of the atom. I think they did.
We did not believe that, apparently.
Right? Germany, Switzerland.
They did polls, and there's actually people that are trying to have people in Manchester or in the UK in general to appreciate a lot of these firsts. Mm-hmm. And a lot more people thought it was Switzerland than here, which is kind of like depressing thinking that. No, it was right here. It's right here where you guys live. Physicist and chemist Ernest Rutherford split an atom, creating the first artificial nuclear reaction in his laboratory in Manchester. Rutherford really was amazing. He's the first guy that realized that nearly the entire mass of an atom this is the atom. Most of the mass is in this tiny little pinprick right in the middle in the nucleus. He was the first one to realize that. So he gave birth to the nuclear model of the atom. And nuclear physics, he is the father of nuclear physics. Because if you don't know about the nucleus of the atom, there's no nuclear physics, obviously. Albert Einstein would later call him a second Newton. I mean, this is Einstein that said that. Amazingly fascinating scientist. His contributions just can't be diminished. And he won a Nobel Prize, but he did a lot of this great stuff after he won, which is kind of the opposite. Usually you win a Nobel Prize when you're maybe
after that,
you're just kind of cruising a little bit. But this guy definitely did not cruise.
And also, Jay and I won science or fiction.
Kara and...
So, let's brag a little, Jay.
Yeah, with Kara and Steve and Jay.
Yeah, they did.
And George. I told you,
it's bullshit.
Is this your first science or fiction of the year?
No. But you haven't won one this year.
I haven't won one ever, I think. So yeah.
Oh, is this your first one ever?
I think it might be.
I do not do well on this game.
I think you might be right.
I do not do well on this game. Yeah.
We'd like to thank you, George, for tonight. Thank you for
joining us. You're welcome. Oh, my goodness. Always a pleasure.
And just so. Evan, why don't you give us a quote to close things out?
British diplomats and Anglo-American types in Washington have a near superstitious prohibition on uttering the words special relationship to describe relations between Britain and America, lest the specialness itself vanish like a phantom at cockcrow. That was written by Christopher Hitchens, his wonderful book, Hitch 22, a memoir. And if they don't say it, I'll say it. Great Britain and America do have a very special relationship.
Yes, we do.
Thank you guys for joining me tonight. George, thanks as always for joining us. And thank all of you in the audience. It was a great show. We appreciate your being here. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions.
dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.